was no longer. Conan said, "It ain't Smokey from Bell Gardens you're talking about, is it?"
"It was," Sammy said.
"Smokey was your boyfriend?"
"I'm from Bell Gardens, and the Smokey I know is a she."
"I didn't know that when I met him," Sammy said. "This fine-ass guy wearing, what are they called, those little white shells around his neck, shows up and we're partying. He's got a bottle of PCP, and the next thing I know, I'm in a motel in Whittier, and it's 2 days later."
"Puka shells," Sergeant McKinley said over the PA. He was in the program office, behind one-way glass, listening to our conversation with long-range microphones.
"I wake up with no memory of how I got there. I'm covered in hickeys, and this person, Smokey, is sleeping next to me. We're both, like, we don't have our clothes on. I peek under the sheet, and he was the same as me down there. I was shocked. We were together for 2 years after that."
Smokey could hotwire any vehicle.
"She would steal a car, we'd party in it, wipe off the prints, and dump it. Once they were in a fight, and Sammy was trying to buy heroin at the hamburger stand in Compton, Smokey came revving up in this horribly loud cement truck, the mixer on the back revolving full tilt. Sammy yelled over the grinding noise for Smokey to shut it off. I could not score with a cement mixer next to me, so I start walking away to lose her and that noisy thing, and Smokey's driving at the speed of my walking. No dealer was going to sell to me creating a scene like that. I'm yelling, turn it off, the what's it called, the spinning thing, and she's going, I don't know how. All she could do was put it in gear and drive it. We were yelling at each other, and finally I got in so we could fight in private. We go driving around in the cement mixer, and we're starting to get along. I'm not mad anymore. The driver had left his lunchbox on the seat. I opened it thinking I'd drink his juice and eat his sandwich, whatever he had in there. And inside the lunchbox is the dude's wallet. Smokey and I got in a fight all over again. She had this crack idea that because she hotwired the cement mixer, the wallet was hers. Nuh-uh, sorry. I took the cash and got out. Our relationship had a lot of drama to it like that. Different ideas on things. When the prison went on lockdown, we got no yard time. Sometimes this was from fog. Other times, staff shortages. My third week, it was because a minimum security prisoner walked off the almond orchard. You have to have 60 days remaining on your sentence to get a job in the orchard, which is outside the prison. The girl who made that decision was blowing everything. Betty learned about it on her television and shouted the news through the pipe. The girl was picked up at her mother's house. She'd gone straight home. Sammy told me no one had ever successfully escaped from inside Stanville. A lifer named Angel Marie Janicki almost did. She got close, I mean this close. She had clothes stashed on the yard, a mechanic's jumpsuit and baseball cap, to disguise herself as one of the contractors working on site. Someone had gotten her a pair of wire cutters. On a day of milk-thick valley fog, she worked in a blind spot of the guard tower along Main Yard. Cut a hole in the fence, passed through, took off walking. A guard leaving the prison saw a figure on the side of the road and was suspicious. The roads around the prison were not for human beings. They were for unmanned industrial agriculture and prison-bound vehicles. She was caught within minutes. Now, Stanville had an electrified fence. Electricified, as Sammy put it. You'll frizzle-fry if you touch it.
What about hiding in the lockbox of a work truck? I asked.
You don't think they check those? They search every vehicle.
Underneath, then, strap yourself to the undercarriage.
They have mirrors on rollers. They check under every vehicle. Unless you've got a lover with a helicopter who can shoot out the guard towers and land on the yard, you're not getting out. Or maybe if you faked a serious medical emergency and got taken to the hospital in Stanville and had an entire crew waiting there to burst you out with grenades and assault weapons and a helicopter, and they also had a new passport, cash, everything you'd need, ready and planned. Week 5 on the Adseg concrete yard, Conan told us about being classified male.
I was at a station somewhere in the valley where they put me with the homies, and I knew to let them make their mistake. You never correct, because their wrong might be your right. You wait, see how it's going to play, see if you were getting some angle from their fuck-up. After half a night there, they rode me downtown. There were so many people processing in when I got to IRC that if you weren't a K-10, they were practically waving you through. I had a lighter and they didn't even see it. Just flashed at my crack and said, next. I got interviewed and they asked, am I gay? I said, yes. Always be truthful when you can. They're asking me, what clubs do you go to? What's upstairs? And I'm guessing, but answering correct. What's the bouncer's name? The cop goes. Rick, I say. Are you sure? He asks. Yeah, I say, but I had guessed wrong, and the cop says, get the fuck out of here. Only real faggots get the gay dorm. No Zumba for you, buddy. The cops kept saying that to me, no Zumba for you. Like I got caught up so I could take a Zumba class in the L.A. Men's Central Jail. I don't even know what Zumba is. I was given the regular dark blue counties instead of the baby blue powder props and put in general population. Turned out fine. I had a cool celly, guy named Chester. I helped him scavenge a piece of ventilation grate from above the shower because I was the tallest person on that tier, and in exchange, he had my back. Men's jail is better in a lot of ways. Better food, good gym equipment, great library, more phones, stronger water pressure. You showered and no one noticed you weren't a guy? I asked him. The men's joint was jumping off, Conan said. People had to stay ready for fighting and riots. Everyone took showers in their boxers and work boots. Suge Knight was in when I was there. The guard said he had $80,000 on his prison books. That's a lot of cup of noodle, lot of deodorant. What did Chester want with the ventilation? I asked. He was making a spear, Conan said. That was the new thing down there, a spear with an extender bar you make out of rolled Bibles. What was he going to do with it? I asked. I don't know. It's not your job to wonder about other people's business. Man, you would not last 1 minute in a men's joint asking fucked up questions like that. From Men's Central Jail, Conan was transferred to Wasco State Prison. At Wasco, going through work exchange strip out one day, they figured out he was biologically a woman. He was put back on the bus, reprocessed at Women's County, and taken to Stanville. One morning, McKinley yelled through the door that my GED prep session was that afternoon.
When staff come back here after lunch, I want no monkey business, Hall.
I had not signed up for the GED, which is the only continuing education offered at Stanville. I had graduated from high school. I was not a bad student when I made the effort. I thought of what Conan said. You don't correct. Their wrong might be your right. That afternoon, I was taken from the cell. It felt like freedom to be chained and hustled down a hallway after weeks of confinement. I was placed in a birdcage in the ADSEG program office and left to wait, listening to the stutter and clank from the sewing machines on death row.
You study real good, Hall. You prove everybody wrong. Show the world you ain't all bad.
McKinley clomped down the hall in his huge boots. If I'd understood how much guards hated civilian staff, I might have been nicer to G. Hauser, which was the name on the ID pinned to the GED instructor's shirt. The guy sat down in a chair next to my birdcage with a stack of worksheets. He was about my age or a little older, with a non-ironic mustache and ugly running shoes. Let's start with something simple. He read the first question on the math worksheet. 4 + 3 = A, 8, B, 7, C, none of the above. You've got to be fucking kidding me. Is that A, 8, B, 7, or C, none of the above? It sometimes helps to use your fingers if you need to count it out. It's 7, I said. I think we can move on to something more challenging. He flipped pages. All right, how about a word problem? If there are 5 children and 2 mothers and 1 cousin going to the movies, how many tickets do they need? A, 7, B, 8, C, none of the above. What movie are they going to? That's the wonderful thing about math. It doesn't matter. You can count without knowing the details. It's hard for me to imagine these people without seeing who they are and knowing what movie they're going to. He nodded, like my response was reasonable, not at all a problem. Maybe we got a little ahead of ourselves. How about we make up a question, he said. Or rather, we take the question and simplify it. This guy had the patience of a genuine idiot. There are 3 adults and 5 children. How many tickets do they need? There was no sarcasm in his voice. G. Hauser was so determined to work with whoever he thought I was that I could not play along. If the theater lets kids in free, how can I know how many tickets they need? And, depending on what kind of people they are, what theater this is, are they ghetto or are they squares like you? Because maybe they let in one of the adults, like that cousin, through an emergency side door after they pay for 2 tickets. I saw the plush-stained carpet of the multiplex out by the Oakland airport, the one where a cousin would push in through the emergency exit instead of pay. It's probably gone, like all the other theaters I used to know. The Strand on Market, where as kids, Eva and I drank Ripple wine with grown-ups. The Sarah in Daly City, which showed Rocky Horror. The Surf out by the beach, where I went with my mother when I was young for a movie starring the actress I'm named after. The movie kept showing the same car accident in slowed segments. I guess I asked too many questions, because finally my mother yanked me from my seat and said we were leaving. I had ruined the film for her. They're squares, G. Hauser said. Like me. The kids all have to have tickets? He nodded. The answer is 8. Excellent, he said. You just congratulated a 29-year-old woman for adding 3 plus 5. I have to start somewhere. What makes you think I can't count? There are women here with a numeracy who have trouble adding sums. I can give you a GED practice test, and if you're confident you'll pass, I'll schedule you to take it. I don't need a GED, I said. I'm here because I was called out here. You might think you don't need a degree, but in the future, when you are facing your release, you'll be glad to have it. I'm not getting out, I said. He went into a calm and semi-robotic spiel about people who don't have release dates and the numerous long-termer programs for which I'd be eligible with a GED. I didn't explain that I was a high school graduate. I said I'd think about it and was taken back to the cell. Jimmy Darling used to do math with Jackson for fun. It started with a lesson about the history of counting at the picnic table on the ranch in Valencia. Jimmy drew a circle on a piece of paper. This is a stable where the man keeps his animals, Jimmy said. He drew 3 circles for the animals. What kind of animals? Jackson asked. I guess we both like to know the irrelevant information. Sheep, how about? Jimmy said. The farmer has 3 sheep, and they each have names. Sally, Tim, and Joe. Every morning, the farmer lets the sheep out to graze. In the evening, he herds them back into the pen. Since there are only 3, he can easily go over the short list of their names and confirm that Sally, Tim, and Joe are all safely back in their enclosure for the night, where they won't be eaten by wolves. But let's say the farmer has 10 sheep instead of 3. If he names each one, he has to remember 10 names when they return. He has to recognize 10 sheep. Each name goes with a specific sheep. If Sally is the pregnant sheep, then he can recognize her broad belly and check her name off when she returns from grazing. But let's say the farmer has 30 sheep. Too many to name, right? So he gets a basket of rocks, exactly enough so that he has 1 rock for each sheep. He takes a rock out of the basket for every animal that leaves the enclosure in the morning. As each returns in the evening, he puts a rock in the basket. When all the rocks have been moved back into the basket, he knows that all of his sheep are safely home. The sheep don't need names anymore. The farmer just has to know how many there are. He explained to Jackson that numbers started with counting, and counting started with names. It was like prison, from a name to a number. Except my number was more like a name than the rock that went with the animal, because the rock could go with any animal, and my number went only with me. Although we had count every day. Count was a total count for the number of people in prison, and not by inmate numbers. So we were both animals that did not graze, and individuals who could not be confused. When they escorted us out for the weekly yard time, we could see down into the caged area of death row. Sammy hollered from the catwalk, "Candy Pena, I love you! Betty LaFrance, I love you!" Candy looked up. Her face dimpled into a sad smile. They were down there on their sewing machines, sewing a seam onto burlap, then moving the fabric 90 degrees, another seam, turning the material again to run a third seam, before tossing the piece on a pile. I didn't see Betty, who often refused to work and lost her privileges. They sewed sandbags on death row, nothing else. They had 6 machines, and they sewed sandbags for flood control. If you see a pile of sandbags along the side of a California road, they have been touched by the hands of our celebrities. Payment is 5 cents an hour, minus 55% restitution, and the work is repetitive and lacks the satisfaction of making even a single finished thing. They are not completed. They still have to be filled. Who completes the bag? My guess is men. Men fill it with sand and close up the top. Other times when we showered, they were on the 2 phones down there on death row, or waiting for the phones, talking to journalists and lawyers, Sammy explained. The women on death row worked the media and were always communicating with folks in the outside world. They knew all kinds of people on account of who they were. They led people on and suggested they might consent to interviews or visits, promises they did not plan to keep. They weren't interested in doing interviews. They were interested in having people to call, people who wanted something from them. It felt good to be pursued. It was a game to get attention, a game that was not a game because it was all they had. We were not allowed mail or phone calls in ADSEG. Still, I felt lucky compared to the women downstairs talking to the Fresno Bee. My mother would come to the prison with Jackson as soon as I was allowed a visit, after I was done with this ADSEG term and transferred, mainlined, to general population. She would put money on my books so that I could buy what I needed, coffee and toothpaste and stamps, in order to survive. Sammy kept telling me how important it was to have someone on the outside, but I didn't let her know I had support. Or that I had 2 life sentences, plus a 6-year enhancement. It was no one's business but mine. Like in the dressing room at the Mars Room, you don't give your real name. You don't offer information. You don't talk about yourself because there is nothing to be gained from it. Sammy had been back in ADSEG the night that Candy Pena received her execution papers. Candy had to choose which method she preferred and sign the form. Sammy listened to Candy Pena cry as she read the paper that offered her gas or injection. "We turned out our lights to protest," Sammy said, "and everyone on ADSEG refused their dinner tray. It creates a lot of paperwork for the staff. They have to fill out forms for every person who refuses her tray and turns out her security light." Candy was screaming over and over. Everyone on ADSEG and death row was crying. Even the guards were crying. There was one handicapped lady who accepted her dinner tray, but I think she just didn't understand what was going on. Candy chose lethal injection. Candy Pena had knifed a little girl. She was out of her mind on meth and PCP when it happened. She prayed daily, hourly, minute by minute, at the altar she'd made in her death row cell to honor the little girl. She cried and signed the papers. And Sammy was a human, if sometimes a bully, and she felt for Candy. You go to ADSEG, and you don't stop having feelings. You hear a woman cry, and it's real. It's not a courtroom where they ask all the pertinent and wrong questions, the niggling, repeated demands for details to sort contradiction and establish intent. The quiet of the cell is where the real question lingers in the mind of a woman. The one true question. Impossible to answer. The why did you? The how? Not the practical how, the other one. How could you have done such a thing? How could you? Sammy's crime was that she'd wet the bed. She told me all about it. I know I said you don't give out personal data in prison, but Sammy told me everything. When I was 4, we lived in a trailer, and there was no electricity because my mother was an addict and had to spend whatever money she could get on dope. At night, I would pee in the bed to warm it up. I got a rash on my legs. A neighbor saw my legs and called CPS. Child Protective Services took Sammy away. She was in and out of group homes and wound up in youth authority, where she learned to fight. You get a lot of skills there you'll need for prison. By 12, she was out of YA, back with her mom, and turning tricks to support her mother's habit. The men liked young company. Her first sugar daddy was a bail bondsman named Maldonado. She eventually got strung out herself, was arrested, took a narcotics number, a never-never number, she called it, and had been in and out of prison ever since, on sales and trafficking charges. Her mother was long dead. Many people she'd been in YA with were here at Stanville. Her network was extensive. It was a lifetime of prison connections. Sammy had paroled 6 months earlier. Her time out of prison had been brief. She was eager to mainline in order to reclaim her possessions. She had a television, a personal fan, a stinger to heat water. Her friend Reebok had her eye mask. It's got little piggies on it, she said, and I want it back. She'd given things away, but on the condition that if she returned, she'd be able to repossess. She knew her leaves from prison were just that, not departures, but vacations. But she had not expected to be back quite so soon. Sammy had been released to a new husband, a guy she met through the mail. It all started with a letter he wrote, but not to Sammy. He'd written the letter to another woman inside Stanville, and that woman treated the letter as currency, something to sell to another prisoner who wanted a pen pal. People were always looking for pen pals. Someone would surely pay to start an exchange with this guy. The letter had been read by so many women when it got to Sammy that its pages were tearing on the crease lines where it had been folded and refolded. The letter and its writer, Keith something, I never caught the last name, had potential, and so the woman who had received his letter kept raising the price. When the letter got to Sammy, bidding for it had risen to over $50. The high bidder would get the envelope with Keith's return address. Sammy told me that as soon as she started reading it, she knew the letter was worth more than $50, a lot more. His writing was like a third grader's, she said with a grave tone, as if to suggest that such a thing denoted immense value. Even his own name was misspelled, she said. K-E-A-T-H? Who the fuck spells it that way? Keith had victim written all over him and his misspelled name. The woman selling the letter had used a photo of a high school beauty queen on her prison pen pal page. People put up photos they found or traded. Someone's daughter, someone's cousin, someone, not themselves. It was crucial to have runners, people who sent you money inside. One way to get runners was to find men to write to you. Keith had written to what he thought was this high school beauty queen, but was merely a woman who had used that photo. She was an elderly prisoner who'd suffered throat cancer and had a mechanical larynx. She held a battery-operated box to her neck to negotiate a price with Sammy, who offered her CD player as payment. The woman handed over the envelope with Keith's address. Sammy wrote to Keith and introduced herself, said she'd felt an instant connection when she'd read his letter. A courtship began. She was paroling in a few months and needed not your typical runner, but someone to go home to. An apartment, financial stability, and proof of gainful employment, or the parole board would never let her free. Sammy had an old boyfriend named Rodney who might set her up at his place in Compton, but Rodney hit her, she told me, and she was done with that. Keith started to seem like the answer. Keith said he had been in the Air Force and flew planes and had a good military pension. When he came to the prison for the first time, he proposed to Sammy. He was a big, lumbering and doughy white boy with a wandering eye. She said yes, but could not bring herself to let him kiss her in the visiting room. Like the rest of us, she'd done all kinds of sex work, but she couldn't let this innocent dope plant one on her cheek. She told him she'd lost her privileges and could not hug or kiss. Keith believed it.
"Oh, golly, I don't want to get you in trouble," he said. "Why don't we just shake hands?"
She paroled. They married at a county courthouse not far from Stanville, in Hanford, a dusty farming town where Keith's father sold tractor equipment. His family had fixed up an apartment for them and made everything in it blue, because Sammy had said it was her favorite color. Blue curtains, blue couch, blue microwavable bowls. She didn't have a favorite color. She was just saying things to Keith she thought he wanted to hear. She'd said blue because it was what she was wearing that day in the visiting room, like every other prisoner in the visiting room. There she was, a Mexican girl from Estrada Courts in East L.A., living in a small town in the Central Valley with a corny white husband who, it turned out, had never flown planes, never been in the Air Force, and instead spent all day watching car racing on TV. He said he was going to Daytona, talked incessantly about Daytona. Once a month, he filled out his SSI forms with his left hand, so the government would think he was slow, even slower than he already was. His big, doughy, small-town family didn't know anything about Sammy and didn't ask where it was Keith had met her. He took her to a picnic down the I-5. It was a gathering for people who liked to pretend they were fighting the Civil War. There were log cabins where women in old-timey clothes were making biscuits. Keith wanted Sammy to join the other women. Sammy had never made anything but prison spreads. She could whip up a prison cheesecake from Sprite and non-dairy creamers, or tamales from canteen Doritos that were soaked in water and hand-pulped to masa. She stood awkwardly, wishing she had worn long sleeves to hide her prison tattoos. "I love your tan," one of the white women told Sammy as she rolled out her white biscuit dough. The men were firing cannons. One blew into a bugle. Keith was a pretend captain in the pretend army and won a real sword that day. "He had to get rid of it," Sammy explained while they were on the long drive back to Hanford. She was a level 4 on parole. No firearms and no knives over 10 inches long, or she would go right back to prison. "Aw, darn it." Keith blew air and flapped his lips like a child. Like a Keith something who lives in a dream. Gets himself a Serenia from Stanville, takes her to a picnic where white people admire her tan. But after that, Keith never took her anywhere. He only left the house himself one evening a week. Sundays, when he worked as a volunteer security guard at the Red Cross. He made a big deal about it, always took a briefcase with him, and said it held important documents that he needed to study for his next Daytona run. It wasn't really a briefcase. It was the emptied container for a backgammon set. Once, Sammy opened it. It was filled with candy bars. Sammy had no money, no car, was trapped with a meat-headed halfwit in an apartment next to a feedlot. Keith spent his days swiveling left and right in a chair, like he was on the racetrack that was inside his TV. He wore a shiny Daytona race shirt that said Pennzoil over the shoulder. Sammy started asking him for money. He reluctantly gave her a few ones. She would walk to the dollar store, buy a quart of malt liquor, drink it while talking to the farm workers who lived in the shacks behind the parking lot. One night she came home drunk. Keith was swerving in his chair as race cars jerked around the track on TV. Sammy could not take it anymore. She picked up a heavy glass ashtray and beamed him with it, then ran from the apartment. She was a fugitive with no place to go. At a railroad crossing, she heard a siren in the distance. She hid behind a switching box, waiting for the sound to fade, and then followed the train tracks. She got to the freeway and stood on the southbound shoulder until she found a ride. Sammy knew Skid Row, had survived there on and off between prison stints, and that was where she went. It was a place where a person could disappear if she was careful. She managed to elude arrest for several months, but eventually got picked up in a sweep. Keith pressed charges, but they never went through a divorce proceeding, and as far as Sammy knew, she was still married to this idiot country boy living right close by. On our weekly hour in the paved outdoor cage, I spotted the GED teacher through the razor wire. He was on a path going into the ADSEG housing block. I yelled a hello. He called back through the barbed coils. "Have you given any more thought to whether you want to work toward the GED?" I said I had not. "Let the administration know if you want to take the test. The questions were easy for you, and that's a good indicator, although I didn't give you a reading assessment." "I know how to read," I told him, "and I graduated from high school." He nodded. I didn't realize. I could have gone to college. I got into UC Berkeley. I wasn't much of a liar before I got to prison. The instinct to lie to staff and guards is automatic. They fucked with us, we fucked with them. No kidding, really. That's where I went to school. I gave him a story about how sad I was not to be able to enroll, because my father was ill, and so I had to take care of him. "I really miss reading," I said. "I love to read books." Not a lie. "I'd be happy to get you some reading material if you'd like. And now that I know you're at a higher level, it won't be GED workbooks, I promise. What do you like to read?" "What do you like to read?" Sammy said, imitating him, after he'd walked away. "That guy looks like a serious Vic. Could be your own personal Keith." Sammy made a motion like reeling in fishing line. "Do it slow, do it right, and you're looking at Keith, too." I pretended to be interested in reeling in the GED instructor, but only because I felt sorry for Sammy, who had to look at everyone as a possible victim, when victim meant savior. The turkeys I'd seen from the prison bus the morning after chain night, their feathers wind-plucked and swirling in the car lanes, had not been headed for Stanville. Thanksgiving Day marked 1 month in ADSEG. We had our holiday meal shoved through the flap. I looked at my tray. On it sat a large and meaty drumstick. Unusually large. I had never seen a drumstick so large. "Every year here it's like this," Sammy said. "What do you mean?" "Oversized Thanksgiving meat. People say it's emu." "Emus are big, ugly, aggressive birds that rise to 6 feet when they stretch upward. The neighbor next door to the ranch where Jimmy Darling stayed had emus. They sometimes got onto the property and wandered around. They were like people, violent and unpredictable, with brains the size of walnuts." After the disgusting meal, McKinley led us on the caged concrete square, a special privilege on account of the holiday. It was freezing. The sky was the bleak white of old kitchen appliances. Wind blew dust into our eyes as we sat on the ground, waiting to watch staff or guards walk by on the other side of the razor wire. Such was the excitement we lived for. A nurse ran past, then two more. Conan yelled, "Save a life!" The way he yelled it made their mission less of an emergency, made it funny. Life didn't matter much. It was something for Conan to yell while watching the breasts of the nurses bounce up and down. I was hungry. I had not eaten my emu. Sammy hadn't eaten hers either. "If I wasn't stuck in ADSEG, I could have sold that drumstick," Sammy said. "Black girls will add it to stuffing mix and canned corn. I saw a black chick smuggle a big bird leg from chow last year, got a blistering burn on the inside of her thigh." "Why you gotta be so racist?" Conan said. "Black girls this, black girls that. Just because we run this prison." "We could've run this place," Sammy said, meaning Latinas, "if most of us weren't high." "Good idea, though, to trade up for a spare drumstick, mix it with corn and stuffing," Conan said. "Maybe squeeze in some nacho cheese, add pickled jalapenos." They weren't fucking around with that piece of meat. It was serious. That was no Mortimer portion. Mortimer was supposedly a woman at Stanville who sued the prison. Because of her, they had to serve us exactly 1,400 calories a day so that we could not sue them for our fatness like Mortimer did. The Mortimer portion is not enough food. But instead of blaming the prison, the staff tells us to blame Mortimer, who ruined things for the rest of us by filing a 602 inmate complaint that became a frivolous lawsuit. There were a lot of rules like that, with a prisoner's name attached to them. To get medication, you stood in an Armstrong box. The Armstrong box is a red square painted on the floor around the pill counter. It's for privacy. If you were not called to the window, if you were even just walking down the hall and your foot went over the red line of the box, you got a 115, thanks to a paranoid named Armstrong. We hated the prisoners who ruined it for everybody else, but these people probably didn't exist. Sammy told me where 602s actually went, into a paper shredder in the assistant litigator's office. I doubted a prisoner could make history, get her name attached to a new rule, when it was impossible to even lodge a complaint in the first place. People say holidays are depressing in prison. It's true. It's because you cannot help but think of the life you once had, or did not have. Holidays are an idea of how life should be. My last free world Thanksgiving I had squandered. I worked day shift at the Mars Room. Men don't holiday from their addictions. Holidays are busy because the men need to escape from their real lives into their really real lives with us, their fantasies. No one forced me to spend Thanksgiving at the Mars Room. I didn't need the money that badly on that particular day. Why didn't I do something with Jackson? I'd given him to my neighbor to watch. She and some friends made a meal. The kids had fun. I sat with Kurt Kennedy in a dark theater. At that point, I'd eased myself into the hustle of having a regular. I was by instinct against it, but it had presented itself as a novel certainty. He would be there on my shift. He would choose me automatically. I would not scan the room and circle, waiting for someone who had decided on his lunch hour, in his dark fiefdom, the Mars Room, that I was the one he felt like paying for company. They get what they need or see something better, someone else, and tell you to go away. With a regular, that moment doesn't come. I was someone's choice before I even got to the theater, before he got there. Kennedy's choice. He would hand me, over the course of a few hours, several hundred dollars. All he wanted was to pretend I was his girl. "You're my girl, right?" The rough, dry skin of his hands on my thighs. The gravelly voice. He did most of the talking. He'd been shot in the leg while doing his job, and that was why he limped. He said he was a detective or something, but later he said that wasn't really true and talked for a long time about his actual job, and I wasn't listening and didn't care what he did, nor if he lied or told the truth. He was on disability and had too much free time. He wanted to take me out on his boat. "I hate boats," I didn't say. "Sure, that sounds like a lot of fun. You have no idea how much it costs to pay for a slip in that harbor." "I sure don't." "It's $20,000 a year," he said, handing me another 20. "Uh-huh." "Do you like to be spanked?" "I want to spank you." Passed me another 20. Sometimes his bills were new and had a crisp, smooth feel that made me want to check to be sure they were real. Money is money. The great neutralizer, that is work and this is payment. "I'd like to make your ass red. Oh God, I mean bright fucking red." Slapping it lightly with his rough hand, the lightness of his slap. He was lost in thought, if you called that thought. There would not be any spanking sessions. There was no need. I was his virtual reality machine as I pushed my ass into his clothed lap to empty his wallet. When the wallet was empty, either he would go to the bank machine in the lobby of the Mars Room and get more, or he wouldn't. But if he didn't, he would be back tomorrow. A few days after Thanksgiving, Sergeant McKinley said there was a message for me in the program office. I walked, cuffed, with McKinley and another cop behind me. At the program office, I faced Lieutenant Jones.
"You have a deceased relation," Jones said.
"Relation?"
"Your mother," is what it says.
There are 3,000 women at Stanville. It happens all the time that you get the wrong information. You're HIV positive when you're not, or they give you someone else's mail. I was sure Jones had something wrong, or that she was tormenting me because it was her role to torment. I said I didn't believe her.
"Gretchen Becker," it says here, "died in a car accident last Sunday, November 30th.
"No," I said, "no, that can't be right."
"She and a child were both admitted to San Francisco General Hospital,"
Jones mechanically read.
"Child sustained non-life-threatening injuries."
"That's my son," I said. "He's only 7. He doesn't have anyone else. I need to get there."
"You need to get there? You have 2 indeterminate state commitments, Hall. You aren't going anywhere."
"That's my son. He's in the hospital.
Hall, if you'd wanted to be someone's mother, you should have thought of that before."
I lunged toward the paper in Jones's hands. I had to see it. McKinley grabbed me. I tried to get away from him. I needed to see the paper. McKinley pushed me to the floor. I was restrained gently by his large boot pressing on my shoulder, holding me down. I knew McKinley didn't want to hurt me. I could feel it. But Jones was a lieutenant, his superior. His boot pressed into me. His boot said, "Your mother is gone." My mother was gone. It was just me and this war.
"Let me see the paper," I said, "please."
I was not calm, it's true. When I said please, I screamed it. "Please, please, give it to me. Give me the fucking paper."
"I used to feel sorry for you bitches," Jones said. "But if you want to be a parent, you don't end up in prison. Plain and simple. Plain and simple."
I tried to get up. More cops were on me. I bit a hand. I didn't know whose. They pushed my head into the floor. I wedged it sideways and spit. I spit at McKinley and got a baton in the back of the head. An alarm sounded. The noise of the alarm bleated in my ears, and all I could do was struggle. "That's my family! It's my son! It's my son!" I tried to lift my head, bucked upward, thrashed my feet until they were pinned, until every part of me was pinned.
Part 2. Chapter 12. Doc had been an early corruptor among detectives at the Rampart Division of the LAPD. He was capering, as he thought of it, long before they got their bad reputation. For that, Doc thought of himself as ahead of his time. The time he was serving was life without, on the sensitive needs block at New Folsom. The sensitive unit had built-in, concrete, stepped seating and a broad stage on which the dayroom dramas took place before a set of automated doors, all blue, each with a small monitor window. Doc's cell was 8x10, like everyone else's, and like everyone else, he shared it. You don't choose your roommate. And in sensitive needs at New Folsom, there is a 100% likelihood your roommate is a child rapist, a snitch, or a transsexual, since that's who Sensitive Needs was built to house. A transsexual cellmate? Doc would be fine with that. He didn't mind men with titties. He'd had a few, not frontally or anything, mostly fondled and explored from behind, an experience that, like everything in life, made sense in its moment. The transsexuals on his unit played powder puff softball, and Doc liked watching the games just as much as the next red-blooded male. They all liked it. Who wouldn't, if you were a straight guy stuck in the joint for life with a bunch of other men? Suddenly, you've got these creatures with big asses and actual real boobies bouncing around under their knit cotton state-issued jerseys as they run bases and jump up and down, cutely helpless at the batter's plate, or run after and never catch a ball that came their way. They were fun and stupid and uncoordinated and smelled good,
just like women. And like women, they had pea brains and spoke in soft, squeaky voices. He would have bunked with one no problem. Instead, he got housed with an unsavory character who had raped his own daughter. The guy said she was a stepdaughter when Doc demanded the new cellmate's paperwork, a custom that was mandatory on sensitive yards. Okay, we all have our stories. Doc talked openly about being raped himself as a child by his foster father. He didn't hassle his roommate. This is prison. No one is friends. You don't need to deal with their feelings. You make rules for the cell and stay out of each other's way. Doc's rules were mostly cleaning protocols. A lot of the guys on sensitive needs at New Folsom had cleaning protocols. The concrete in the common area gleamed like glass. It was so polished and repolished. It was just layers of clean and gleam and perfection. The smell of Cell Block 64 brand cleaning solution in Doc's unit was overpowering. It moved beyond an omnipresent scent to a totalizing sensation, smell as the means of breathing, thinking, being. Doc, a porter on the block, had access. He had his own personal supply of Cell Block 64. He might have used it as cologne, but Doc had money on his books and used actual cologne and not old fucking spice either. Good cologne, by an Italian name brand designer he can never remember. But then he remembers. Cesare Paciotti. It always takes him a minute to retrieve that name. The Cell Block 64 was strictly for keeping dust and dirt off his personal stuff, meaning his contraband. Any property in your cell, if they do a raid or extraction and you didn't buy it and have the records to prove it, you will lose. Anything in your cell not explicitly allowed by the CDC, the California Department of Corrections, is contraband. Excuse them, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, a word they added just this year. But there is no new programming. There is just this bullshit letter, R. Doc lies on his bunk going through his files to find a good image. There's no pornography allowed. They don't have the internet, of course. The mind is where you stash your stroke material. Doc flips through the images he keeps in store. He steps by a wide margin over the memory of the last woman he had sex with, Betty LaFrance, who put him here. He focuses on the era before she hung him out to dry. He sees himself cruising the streets in an unmarked car. If he can get into his old life, he can jumpstart a good scenario. There was that button-nosed cocktail waitress, the bar in Eagle Rock he liked to go to, place called Topper's. Plainclothes cop walks into a bar. He never could remember any follow-through on that joke. Plainclothes cop walks into a bar. Nothing more. It didn't go anywhere. There was the night the cocktail waitress at Topper's was so drunk and high she did not take offense when Doc slipped a $2 Canadian bill, worth less even than two American dollars, into the side of her panties. Ha ha ha. Why was a cocktail waitress wearing nothing but panties? It was part of the mystery of Topper's. It was the only mystery of Topper's. He cracked the mystery, brought her back to his unmarked car, pulled down the panties and put his hand against her crotch. She had used hair remover or wax and felt like a child down there, which was unacceptable to Doc, who was a protector and defender of children. The sensation of her hairless pussy alarmed him and he'd had to pull his hand away. He'd forgotten that part when he selected this file from the mental Rolodex. He'd thrown a crumpled $20 bill at her and told her to get out of his car. Now his mind is creeping into the territory of bad men and innocent children, and instead of conjuring some sexy striptease thing or a woman begging him to put his cock in her mouth, he is dreaming about painting the landscape with an Uzi, painting the whole huge landscape of child molesters. Uzis. There was that kid in tiny sweet tart pink shorts who nicked off her instructor in Las Vegas. Everyone watched the news story on their personal TV. Tens of thousands of men all over the state doing life without parole, like Doc, lying back with cheap, tinny headphones connected to their world machine, hoping to get a glimpse of the moment this child in the candy-colored shorts guns down a grown man with an Uzi. The news showed her engagement, then a pause, and the instructor gives an encouraging, "All right," like, "Way to go, this kid's okay." And then she goes back to blasting, but the news cuts away before she clips him. They never show it, but everyone on Sensitive Needs keeps watching that segment, hoping they will. As if, by watching the segment, each time it replays, they produce the possibility that the news footage might, just might, by some fluke of technology, some glitch of the universe, lead straight into where it is not supposed to go, the part where she fragments her instructor's brain to meat and shards. Doc gently steers himself away from that. He can have anything he wants. It is important to remember this when you are flipping through your storehouse. But sometimes, too many choices is a tyranny. The tyranny of choice, that's not exactly what people think of as the number one problem in prison. And yet, Doc cannot settle on an image right now. His roommate will be gone until the door pops on schedule, and he'd like to use this time productively. Back to when he was still a detective, cruising undetected, up to his mischief on a balmy night. Doc had become a great connoisseur of the bars in Los Angeles where prostitution took place in a frank and natural manner. The Polished Knob on Wilshire in Koreatown, a medieval-themed restaurant with a dungeon in the basement. Bobby London on Beverly and Western, which catered only to Korean men and LAPD, and only LAPD as bribery, and only Doc of the LAPD, and technically it wasn't bribery, it was blackmail. Cop walks into a brothel. He could never remember that one either. There was Las Brisas on a rangely barren stretch of Sunset Boulevard near Dodger Stadium, where cars went 70 miles an hour. You could have sex with the bartender in the stockroom of Las Brisas, and she was gentle and maternal sensual. She smelled of beef tamales and fabuloso, a floral oily fragrance that was not unlike the smell of cell block 64, come to think of it. His visits to Las Brisas started out with tight embraces and groin-to-groin hugs with various ladies who hookered at that establishment. But the visits always finished in the stockroom with the bartender, who smelled like cell block 64. She squirted it in her hand and oiled Doc and herself, and then they did the slippery in-out standing up, Doc pinning her against a stack of cases of canned beer. Generous lady always acted happy, like Doc's orgasm was her pride. He was her big baby boy bringing her a dozen long-stemmed red roses by coming all over the insides of her thighs. Doc takes a deep breath, but quietly, because the door has popped. It will remain unlocked for the next 10 minutes on automatic timer. His roommate returns, sits down on the bunk below. Red roses. There were red roses going full bloom outside the gates of Old Folsom, where he had served time first. He saw them through the closed and secure prison bus window, flowers that were heavy and oversized, and he was sure he was smelling them, never mind the smell on the bus of bleach and body rank. He smelled those big, lazy-headed roses. They were the scent of someone else's freedom, the free world of elderly women in cat-eye glasses and cardigan sweaters, women with upright pianos they do not play, and photos of grandchildren who do not visit, deceased husbands with pre-civil rights buzz cuts, the big creased flabby ears of retirees, men with names like Floyd or Lloyd, the dead husbands of these elderly women with their needle-pointed freedom and their perfect gatepost roses, women who shook their heads as if saying no all the time, a tick of old age or medication, women who were permanently disapproving, like the ones in his own family who did not love him and had given him to foster care. They didn't have sensitive needs back then, when he first arrived at Old Folsom. People had needs, sure, but there was no unit dedicated to protective custodizing a prison population of rats and cops. He didn't wander out much. He'd gotten a threatening letter that was obviously somehow from Betty LaFrance, even though she could not write to him directly. A letter in psycho-blocky print from one Fred Fudge announcing that inmates on his yard would soon know he was nothing but a dirty cop. That was her thing. Come fuck me, dirty cop. And he'd gone for it. He was naive. It was her big mouth that had gotten them busted, and he was sure she was still talking to whoever would listen. He lay in his cell and dreamed of escape. The walls of Old Folsom were giant granite molars extending down into the ground farther than they rose, built by earlier convicts whom Doc resented and envied. Their labor locked him in, and also, they'd been given something to do, an actual project. The American River was the rear boundary of the prison, boiling rapids with a guard tower perched over them. Folsom Prison Blues had been a popular song when Doc was young. Doc was ambivalent on account of Vic, his foster dad, who loved it and was a sadist toward young Doc. Later, as a grown-up with a shotgun bolted to the floor of his squad car, a man with weapons and badges who could no longer be Vic's punching bag, Doc heard that song again. It was on the jukebox at Topper's, and the part about shooting a man in Reno just to watch him die was a truth Doc knew better than most, because he had quite sincerely shot people for that exact reason, although never in Reno. Johnny Cash was a cokehead, which was another thing he and Doc had in common. The singer had the creases in his face, that gaunt, strained look of exertion, like you see on a track athlete clearing the hurdle, but it's from freebasing all night. Vic's only addiction had been beating and raping little Doc. He was otherwise an insurance adjuster who smoked exactly 6 cigarettes per day and occasionally had a glass of Lancers. Vic maniacally policed his yard to be sure Doc raked every last leaf. As a child, Doc had seen Johnny Cash on television performing the famous concert in the cafeteria at Old Folsom, the very cafeteria where Doc later ate his meals when he had the courage to go to chow without fear of being stabbed. There was a riot in the cafeteria the second month Doc was at Old Folsom. Someone didn't get a big enough slice of cake, and 260 men exploded in rage. The guards rushed out of the cafeteria, outnumbered. Doc went under one of the spider tables and watched the floor as utensils, blood, and bits of food hit it. The metal meal trays were used as head-smashing instruments, practically made for that. The cops came back, but on the perimeter, the narrow, fenced outer lane, separated from the cafeteria by a shatterproof wall. They were suited up in riot gear. They threw a tear gas canister into the cafeteria. Someone, a prisoner, caught the tear gas canister and threw it back out. It started to spew in that small lane populated by cops bulked up in riot gear, squeaking and pushing to get past one another and away from the gas that was choking them. The prisoners roared, even as the gas leaked over the wall back into the cafeteria, and made them cry too. Tear gas cry. What Doc liked about the bartender at Las Brisas was a sense of radical acceptance she offered. Sometimes ejaculating all over someone is a way for that person to communicate to you that they take you completely and totally as you are. And there was the old man who sat at the bar at Las Brisas and winked at Doc as he exited the stockroom. And no, he was not a pimp. He was just an old Mexican man with a baked sundial face who liked to sip his tecate and wink at the men, and his wink said, "I'm happy to see what I see and know what I know." Guy goes on a blind date. Doc had that one, the blind date joke. Guy named Richard goes on a blind date with a woman named Linda. They set it up over the phone. This Linda says, "Meet me at the soda fountain." The guy Richard goes to the soda fountain and waits. A young woman walks up to him. "Are you Richard?" she asks. He says yes. She looks him over, says, "I'm not Linda." Doc was once married to a girl from Bulgaria. A temporary arrangement was how he later thought of it. He could never really justify or understand why he'd married her. He would fuck her now if he had the chance. He imagines lifting the Sears nightie he'd bought her long ago and putting his dick into her and moving it around. Sex was so simple, he didn't understand why people had hang-ups about it. He liked to screw. He never had a problem with it. The girl from